Hey, welcome to the CMO Whisper Show. I'm your host, Steve Olensky. Part marketing practitioner, part ad agency veteran, part journalist. I was a writer for Forbes for 10 years. I've had so many insightful conversations over the years with business leaders, to athletes, to celebrities, to, of course, CMOs. The only difference now is instead of sharing those insights through written form, I'm doing it this way. My guest this week is Billie Howard. She's the co-founder and CEO of BrainThrow, the only AI research company that scores customer emotion via human input to create the first ever emotional segmentation datasets. An absolutely fascinating conversation, and here it is. Billie, I know we're still relatively new in our relationship, but is it fair to say it seems like we've known each other a lot longer than just a couple months?
Yeah, it's one of those interesting connections where, you know, I feel like I've known you my whole life. So it's a pleasure to be with you today. And thanks so much for having me on the show.
Absolutely. You're right. It was one of those within 30 seconds. It was like, did we just meet? Like, it feels like we have so much in common. We see things the same way.
You had me at hello, Steve. What can I say?
None. You know what? I might just stop the interview right here. Thanks for coming. Drive safely. I want to get into a bunch of things about the world of marketing, but I want to start with BrainThrow and give you the floor to tell us a little bit about the company, why you started it, what was the need behind it, when it started, you know, what's it all about. So tell us about BrainThrow.
Sure. After I wrote my book, WeCommerce, IBM actually approached me to be a futurist for them to help them better introduce Watson. This was about 4 or 5 years ago, actually 6 years ago, maybe, to creative-minded CMOs. And quite frankly, I had no idea what AI was, but I was intrigued enough to, you know, make myself a little bit uncomfortable, which I believe is always necessary for change. And I flew out to Vegas to their keynote, their marquee conference that they have every year, IBM Think. And I did a keynote on how AI could reimagine storytelling. And it was one of those things where it changes your life, right? So I did that. I did work with them for several years. And it occurred to me, once I got into the tech, that it wasn't about the machine replacing man. It was about using the machine to make man better, stronger, and faster. And as a lifelong communicator and marketer, I was really interested in how that could help reimagine marketing, but particularly how it could be used, the technology could be used to bring empathy or emotion to scale. And that was the seed of BrainThrow. And we have been working for the last 4 years to bring that vision to life. And in the most simplistic of terms, what we do is everybody, as you know, every CMO, every brand, every organization has hundreds of different behavioral data sets, which are all about how people act. Yet there is absolutely no segmentation or data sets that are designed to let brands know how people feel. So that's what we've been working on doing the last couple of years. And, you know, while AI suddenly is a flashy buzzword, you know, we've been working with it for a while. And everything that we do is designed to make sure that AI is always married with humanity and used for good. So that's a little bit about us.
I love that. And of course, you're a couple years ahead of the AI curve because you're a futurist.
Well, yeah, it would be bad if I was behind. Then we'd have to call me something else. But yes, that's on brand, hopefully. Yes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. Thanks for that behind the scenes backstory of BrainThrow. I want to get into some topics just about marketing in general. And I want to start with near and dear to me, of course, our CMOs and pain points. And I know what I'm hearing when it comes to CMO pain points. I'm really curious what you think are, you know, right now, and we'll kind of juxtapose over what I'm hearing, but I want to hear your thoughts on, you know, what are the big pain points? What's keeping CMOs up at night that you're hearing?
I'll start broadly. I mean, they're being asked to do a lot more with a lot less. We're hearing a lot of people coming to us actually to help them de-risk their marketing spend and strategy because their budgets have been slashed, but yet the expectations around them have never been higher. The other thing that is a big topic of conversation is build versus buy. So everyone knows that they need to lean into AI and new technologies to freshen the way that marketing departments, you know, are equipped to deal with, you know, what is a real-time environment that old methods and means no longer are significant enough to handle the thresholds and challenges of today. But the number one thing I think that everyone can relate to across the board is we've seen a significant pivot away from an intense focus on customer acquisition that we saw throughout the pandemic, kind of pivot towards the complete opposite, which is a significant spend on loyalty and retention. There's many, many reasons for that, but I think that people realize that if you want to create a relationship with a customer, it's not going to be a transactional one. It's going to be a one that's based off of a relationship. And in order to do that, you need to be able to really understand what makes somebody tick and what makes somebody feel, which is kind of tied to the work that we do, but really get them to subscribe to your brand and deliver value to them in a way that they value. And I think a lot of people are grappling with that from a marketing point of view today. How do you bring that vision of personalization that everyone has been talking about for the last 5 or so years to scale in a way that's meaningful and really one-to-one? We call it one-to-one commercial intimacy. Other people call it other things, but that's what's on everyone's mind from my point of view. What about you? Do you agree?
I do. Look, the pain points, and I know we're gonna get into that two-letter elephant in the room in a second, but agnostic of that, and it's AI is what I'm talking about, in case anybody was curious. Agnostic of AI, which we'll get to in a second, it's a lot of the same things that I've been hearing for years, right? But it's kind of taken on a different tone, if you will, or a different vein. And at the top of that list that I hear is customer experience, which is essentially what you're talking about. I know, mm-hmm. But the experience, it's changing. It's being looked at differently. It's that realization of the personalization has to go way beyond dear Steve and dear Billy, right? Which we all know. But now with so much data available, and I was just having this conversation the other day with a different guest, consumers know. We marketers have a ton of data on them, mm-hmm. right? Even if it's not even opt-in, they know this. And we don't give them enough credit for them. When we send them something that is contextually irrelevant, there's really no reason for that in this day and age. So the pain points I'm hearing is customer experience. How do I really get to that true? My gosh, how long we've been saying this. This true one-to-one marketing, but now with what you're doing is to really kind of bring in, if you will, that emotional side of mm-hmm. the experience. That, right? Is that to me is really exciting. Does that all make sense from what I just said?
Yeah, you nailed it. And I think we said very similar things that were complementary in two different ways. But yes, you people have been investing in getting behavioral data in many ways for many years. And while it might tell you when it's your birthday and that your name is Steve, you know, and you like your pizza with pepperoni, that's great, but it doesn't necessarily explain to you or explain to a marketer what makes you tick, what makes you smile, how they can deliver value to you on a day-to-day basis. And we believe, and others agree with us, that the only way to do that is through more sophisticated means of understanding of customers through the lens of emotion. And that's also something that we're seeing is the evolution, to your point, of not only customer experience, but customer expectation. And what I mean by that is that customer satisfaction, which is scored by NPS, which a lot of people have a love-hate relationship with and are debating its value and if it will stick around or not. Put that aside, I'm not here to say if NPS is good or bad. What I am here to say is that customer satisfaction is not enough. Customer happiness, brand love is what's required, and there needs to be new means of understanding that in real time.
Very well said. Let me ask you one more question just about CMOs in general before we get to that two-letter little elephant. I get asked this a lot, and you advise CMOs and C-levels like I do, but specifically CMOs. And you know the following stat. You've heard it, I'm sure, many, many times, how the CMO, on average, has the shortest tenure in the C-suite. I don't know what the latest Spencer Stuart number is, 36 months, I don't know, 3 to 4 years, something like that.
Maybe less.
Maybe less, right. I have my very definitive reasons why I think that is. But before I share mine, I would like to hear why you think that is. Continually, seemingly forever, shortest tenure, and then we hear about, every once in a while we hear XYZ brand eliminates the role of CMO, and it's the death of the CMO, and like, here we go again. So why do you think CMOs in general have the shortest tenure?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons for that. First of all, being a CMO in one organization versus another, there's absolutely no uniformity in the expectations and the role itself. It really depends where you go and what the organization expects of you. There's also, you know, been so many changes in the skill set of a CMO over the last 10 or so years that there's not necessarily one type of CMO. There's a couple of unicorn CMOs who have all of the skill sets that are required and more. And those are the CMOs who are on the total opposite end of the spectrum who actually have become CEOs. There's about 30 or so CMOs who have become CEOs because they did their job so well. But by and large, you know, CMOs don't have the full breadth of experience that's required because they're either growth marketers or they're brand marketers or there's such a wide swath of expertise that's needed. And it's nobody's fault. And nobody has also told them that the game has changed because now they're also supposed to be in charge of employer brand. They're also supposed to be in charge of workplace experience. It's really an unfair position to be in for the most part. And they're asked to do more with less. So those are my, at least, top line thoughts.
Unsurprisingly, I agree with all of them. I think at the top of my list is when a given brand is going to look to hire a CMO, they don't take the time. I don't want to knock any CEO or CFO, but they don't take the time to fully understand what kind of CMO they need. And you just touched on it between brand versus performance. What are you looking for from the head of your marketing team? And when you can't just hire a CMO to hire a CMO because they have those three letters in their title, it doesn't work that way. So aside from cultural fit, of course, what kind of CMO? And I don't think enough CEOs and CFOs whoever is the hiring team puts enough thought, or I hate to use this word, but are ignorant in it. I don't mean that in a bad way because they don't know what they don't know, but what type of marketer do they need?
Yeah, I think you nailed it in all seriousness. And I would think about it almost in a similar but different way. It's like this, if you think about a really good CMO and what they're supposed to do, irregardless of brand, there's obviously a stray use case here or there, but the CMO is really the quarterback of the C-suite team. They have to work with the CHRO to ensure the employer or brand is on point so that they can recruit and retain talent. They have to work with the CTO or the CIO to ensure that the experience is both physical as well as digital. They're in essence in charge of digital transformation, which needs to happen perpetually almost every day. And there are a lot of CEOs that are in their job that don't necessarily understand what digital transformation is all about. So it's very difficult for them to understand the marketing role, let alone understand what their current role is, because what it means to be a CEO today is entirely different than what it was even 5 years ago.
Correct. Very well put. And I would just add to that, I still get the feeling, and maybe I'm jaded, but far too many CEOs, companies, what have you, don't fully, quote unquote, get marketing and look at it as a sales support role.
Absolutely. They don't get it at all. And if they do get it, they don't understand it. Just like we were talking about brand love before, I guarantee if you ask 100 CEOs, maybe 95 of them would tell you that brand love means, you know, maybe it's not a Super Bowl, maybe they've evolved their thinking, but that it's some type of ad that makes you or I laugh, cry, or do something. That is not what brand love is about, as you and I know. It's about how we feel about a brand every day and how you can consistently surprise and delight me in a way that I value. That is totally different than what most leadership thinks today. So how could they possibly understand the role of a CMO, to your point?
Correct. And look, and a CFO is going to go, just show me the ROI. Well, it's not that easy.
No, it's not. But if you are building a CX that's going to be delivering more and more value across channel, whatever that might be, that is why the CMO and the CFO increasingly do have really good relationships, because a lot of things are driven through e-commerce. And you can understand that when you have happier customers on a day in and day out basis, it shows in the bottom line. And there are many brands that you can cite that are examples of that, because they reimagine themselves around loyalty. They reimagine themselves around intuitive experiences. And all of those things are predicated on better emotional understanding.
Exactly. Okay, let's get to the elephant. I call it the elephant in every marketer's room. I mean, it's been in your room for years, but I'm looking at it from your lens going, where you been? I've been talking about AI for years, right? But you know, marketers, whenever something comes into vogue, the whole world, oh my God, I got to get an AI. So why now? Why is this now coming into so much? Is it ChatGPT? Is that open the floodgates?
I think so. I mean, I think that people were, you know, afraid of it for so long until it became such a part of mainstream culture because of OpenChatGPT, because of, you know, all these buzzwords around generative AI, you know, that people actually were like, oh my, we have to talk about it. And the problem is that it's almost become like the word innovation in years ago. When Clayton Christensen described what innovation was or disruption was, he was very specific about it. And then everyone started saying we're innovative. And then ultimately it meant nothing. I think that the same idea is what's going on with AI. I think the majority of people who talk about it have no idea of actually what it is. If you ask 9 out of 10 people what is AI, I wouldn't be surprised if they did not give you a clear understanding of what it actually is, regardless of the application. So generative AI, yes, it helps produce more creative assets, for example, for a marketer. But how does that happen? It happens because AI trains data sets. I don't think a lot of people understand that. And if you think about what it actually means and then how you apply it, whether it's how we do it through emotion, whether how you can do it with large language models or whatever, you have something that's helpful, but it's going to help man, not replace man. And that's why you have a lot of these conversations taking place, because I believe that a lot of people are ill-informed on what AI actually has the capacity to do alone. And when you think about what it has the capacity to do alone, I think that that's actually a little scary.
So it sounds like you're saying and implying or intimating or flat out declaring that there's an educational aspect to this that needs to happen.
I absolutely think so. I think that there needs to be, you know, at a certain point, just like they're finally approaching data privacy for a reason, I think that they're going to need to approach some type of regulation around AI. If you look at what data privacy did left unchecked, you know, it kind of destroyed a lot of our critical institutions in our country, the traditional media being one of them. We don't want that to happen in this situation. We can't overcorrect with technology. And I think a lot of the smartest brands in the world and the smartest people who are leading those brands recognize that and have taken a step back to say, whoa, while technology, whatever kind it may be, is super, super important, we absolutely cannot forget the value of doing any type of technology through the lens of humanity. And I think we're at a market correction point, hopefully, that will become a little bit more widespread, because the smartest people I know are at that point now.
It's interesting where you went. When I used the word education, that's not what I was thinking, but I loved where you took that. When I used the word education, I was thinking of the context literally of educating marketers, right, on what AI is and what it can do, kind of thing. But I loved where you took that.
Well, I agree with you that marketers should be educated. But I think that if you're a responsible marketer and you're one of those, you know, 1 in 10 marketers versus one of many marketers, you should take the responsibility of educating yourself. And I think that there's a reckoning going on right now. If you go back to one of the earlier questions that we discussed of challenges that CMOs are facing, the people who are bold enough are going to build their own shops, of which AI is going to be a part of it, because they're going to understand what each tool and technology actually does. The people who are going to buy are never really going to understand what they're buying, but they're going to be able to say, just like a lot of big players out there, that they have the bright, shiny object, but when you push them on it, do they really? Because what are they doing that's different besides saying the word AI?
Exactly. Exactly. Do you get the sense that there are X number of CMO/marketers out there who kind of go, I know I need to be doing something. I'm just not sure what yet when it comes to AI. And with each passing day, they get this growing sense of FOMO, right? You know, like I get that sense and I hear it from some. And to your point about self-educating, well, I would volley back to you going saying, what I hear is they go, but we don't know who to trust. We don't know where to go. Because now there's so many, because you know, the minute any money can be made from anything on this planet, someone's going to put up a storefront and go, I'm the expert. How do you identify the reputable sources?
It's a great point. And I think that for me, you know, I'm always trying to do a smell test, right? To see, because there's a million people talking about it. I'm not looking at it from an education standpoint. I'm more looking at it from a competitive standpoint. Like, is there anybody out there that we need to worry about that's maybe leaning into something that's our space or can show us something? And I think that that's why thought leadership today has never been more important, because you can take out an ad, you can do whatever you want to do from a traditional marketing and advertising point of view about, we have this new tool, we have this, we have that. You know, you can put, you know, where Watson was first introduced was at the US Open, and it, you know, counted the serves and the volleys and whatever. But at the end of the day, when you push into somebody who's actually talking about AI. I did a column this week with Jitinder Singh, who is the head of global data and analytics at Accenture Song. They are the real deal. Their CEO is David Droga. I'm sure that most people don't need to be educated on who he is, but they've set out to create the world's leading creative technology company. And when you read their work and you see what they're doing, you understand that that's real. When you look at some of these other holding companies, who, you know, are doing magic card tricks and, you know, saying that they've trained all of these brains to do X, Y, and Z. Well, to me, that's a lot of hocus pocus. So I think the proof is in the pudding, and the thought leaders are out there writing about it, educating about it through example.
Yeah, I think that last part is really key. Through example. Show me. You can tell me you know all about this, but show me. Because there's probably, and I haven't, if I Google AI experts, for example, I'll get a bazillion pages, but it's the ones I like it to, by the way, when social media came into vogue and everybody and their brother was a social media expert within a month.
Exactly. Or an influencer or a citizen journalist or what. And now look at where we're at. We don't want that to happen, right?
This is too important.
Yeah. It is. And that's why, you know, you also need to look at the source. You know, if you want to look at a blog that somebody wrote on their own, you know, by themselves, that says how fabulous they are, there is a reason that thought leadership is very important. It's because it requires third-party validation. So look at what the industry analysts are saying, the Gartners of the world, the Foresters. Look at what actual outlets who cover business and marketing are saying. Look at the Harvard Business Review. I mean, I looked at the Harvard Business Review a couple of years ago to prove out some thinking that I had on, you know, would insights powered by AI and technology, was there promise there? And I read a piece called The Democratization of Insights, where Satya Nadella of Microsoft worked with a major pharmaceutical company to democratize insights, to reimagine how business was done and drive transformation. I was like, oh, there must be something to this thinking. So we are on the right path. Look at where I'm reading this and who's doing it.
Yeah, that's a great advice, right? It's the ultimate, you know, the cliche of consider the source.
Yes, absolutely. Because there's a lot of people out there putting themselves on panels, putting out research and talking about AI. But there's a huge difference about talking about AI and actually making meaningful business difference and change through AI. And I think that you'd be hard pressed to find a lot of people in the latter category.
I agree. And I would be very leery of anyone who ever says, I know all there is to know about AI.
That's a recipe for disaster, no matter what follows. But
Exactly. No, I'm being a little facetious, but I can guarantee you there are people out there touting that claim.
Absolutely.
I want to go back to something we talked about at the top or near the top was emotional segmentation. Mm-hmm. It's a very interesting phrase because, you know, as marketers, and I go back to showing my age here, I go back to direct mail marketing, right? And it was and always will be, who are your segments, right? How are you breaking them down? What's your demographics? Call whatever you want. It's segmentation. But those days, it was all very much black and white, right? Your age, your gender, your geo. That's how you segmented your audience. The word emotional in front of the word segmentation, to me, changes everything. So I want to dive into how marketers can take emotional segmentation and use them not only internally, but with their agency partners as well.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, it's a solve for a lot of the things that we've been talking about today. Number one is really how do you follow through on that promise of one-to-one marketing or one-to-one commercial intimacy at scale. And the way that you do that is you have to understand not only the what, which is what you find in demographic data or behavioral data, which is how someone acts, to get to the why, which is our focus in emotional segmentation or emotional data, which is all about how people feel. And it's not that we're suggesting that emotional segmentation replace traditional segmentation. What we're suggesting is creating emotional lookalikes of who your audiences are. So you have a layer of emotional intelligence to add on top of it so that you can understand not only who the people are, but what triggers one person emotionally to behave in one way versus another. So if you're scoring different parts of the brand experience by emotional relevance and emotional intensity, and you're scoring different component parts of the brand experience, whether it's creative assets, taglines, images, commercials, whatever it might be, based off of how they feel primarily from an emotional point of view, so the 6 primary emotions, as well as with 12 secondary emotions, you have for the first time predictive and quantifiable emotion that can happen as early as the strategy stage. And that solves for de-risking the spend, being asked to do more with less, understanding through emotions what things are going to engender loyalty. We get that through a combination of 3 emotions, valued, respected, and admired. What things are engendering the most trust, we get that through what stimuli or parts of the experience are eliciting the most brand love. And you basically have an emotional GPS to guide you so that you're following through on delivering to Mary in St. Louis what is most important to her, which quite frankly might be the same thing. She's a millennial. She might have the same emotional needs as Sam in New York, who's Gen Z. And you would never know that unless you looked at them emotionally. So it debunks traditional segmentation. It creates what we call emotional phenotypes. And it really allows for cross-functional selling that never existed before, simply because you're interweaving and inter-understanding different emotional traits across category. It also helps too, because we do micro segmentation, it helps to solve for one of the major problems with traditional segmentation, which is traditional segmentation sits in monoliths. You know that no better than anybody else. Well, when you look out the window at the world today, you don't just see Black people. You don't just see white people. You don't just see Asian people. You see white people who have Asian descent within them. You see Black people who have Hispanic ancestry in them. We're able to mix different permutations of cohorts, or for example, in the LGBTQ world, we busted up the L, the B, the T, the G, and the Q. And while they respond in one way, emotionally behave as an overall cohort, when you cut them into different individual slices, they behave quite differently emotionally. So these are the things we're trying to solve for and why we think the time for what we're doing is now. And we're using AI as one ingredient in the cake that we're making, an important one, but it's one ingredient that goes along with data science, machine learning, and decades of marketing experience to create this technology to solve for problems that marketers actually have.
Thank you for that. That was incredible. And listening to you, I was reminded of something I wrote years ago. And I forget the actual, it was something like, these are the most seven dangerous words in history. And the seven words were, that's the way we've always done it. The point being, throughout history, if we had just set, never changed, no innovation, nothing, we first of all, we'd be sitting in the dark. There'd be no light bulb and everything else. And now juxtaposing over marketers going, whoa, whoa, whoa. You're talking about traditional segmentation. So one, you're not suggesting, because you flat out said it, this replaces that, this augments that. But I can still hear, and I'm curious to hear, if you're getting that skepticism and cynicism when you bring up emotional segmentation, because that's how we've never, you know, we've always done it this way. Are you hearing anything like that?
Yeah, of course. When you suggest that people do something differently, you know, there's always pushback. That's why there was pushback on AI for the last 4 years. But there comes a day of reckoning when one must deal with the realities of what's going on. And the reckoning for bringing to scale this notion of personalization, if you're going to do that, you're going to have to change the way things have been done, which is why I also suggested, I'm not saying you should throw away your NPS score, but if there was an emotional score that let you know, not how satisfied your customers are, but how happy and in love with you they are on a regular basis, wouldn't you want to know that too? It's people have spent millions, if not billions of dollars transforming their organizations, and they've forgot that they have to transform their market research, their insights, and their customer understanding. And I think that day of reckoning is now. So while we'll always receive pushback on doing things differently, the time seems to have come. But, you know, there'll always be skeptics, right?
Oh, yeah, of course. And they'll be the ones who are left behind, literally and figuratively.
That's right. You know, we've been working with some of the world's, you know, most emotionally charged brands because they get it, you know, whether they're in auto, whether they're in not-for-profits, whether they're in spirit and liquor, you know, there is a whole emotional insurance. There, when you need to really think about a major thing that you're going to purchase or you're going to be a part of, you know, you need to understand people emotionally. And that's what we're seeing. You know, we were able to work with one of the top vodka brands in the world to establish that there was no loyalty in the category and to figure out exactly how to emotionally engage Hispanics and Blacks on premise, to the point that engagement jumped by 46% and there was an overall increase in sales of 27%. So we're not just talking about emotion to make people smile, while that's very nice. We're talking about emotion as a new currency of business. And, you know, McKinsey did the same thing about a decade ago with creativity. They said those who invest in creativity are going to outperform in the S&P 500. And they did. It's our vision that the same thing can and should and hopefully will happen with emotion.
Okay, I'm looking at the time. And if you've listened to at least one of my episodes, not just you or anybody, you know how I like to wrap things up, and that's bring in music. And I'm a big music fan. The album wall behind me, the now famous album wall. And music played a big part in my life. And I love to tap into each of my guests' music. And you know, my favorite song of all time is a song called Lean On Me. The lyrics have always resonated with me since I was a child, and they really resonate with me as an adult. So my question is, any song, any artist, any lyric from a musical standpoint, Billy, that means just a little bit more, and why?
Well, it's funny when people ask me about my music taste, I say that I have the musical taste of a 70-year-old man because I love the Grateful Dead. I love the Doors. And one of my favorites that don't necessarily fall in the 70-year-old man category is Depeche Mode. And I will say that Depeche Mode created its first album without one of its founding members this year. Unfortunately, one of their members, Andy, passed away. He was the keyboardist. And the music that they wrote this song called Ghost that they put on their new album that we'll all be ghosts again one day, which was a tribute to him. It's one of the most beautiful things because they endeavored forward in great pain to create one of the greatest albums that they've made in the last 30 years. So I would leave you with that because I found that beautiful. And I also find it reflective of what people need to do in business today.
That's a great way to end this. Listen, Billy, thank you so much. I'm so glad we met. You're a phenomenal guest and just a brilliant, brilliant person. I'm so glad you came on. Thank you.
Thank you so much. You know, I feel the same way about you. And as I said, you know, I feel very blessed that we met, and I feel like, you know, I have a friend for life. So thanks for having me on. And thanks for all that you do for the marketing community.
Well, that wraps up another episode of the CMO Whisperer Show. I hope you shared this episode with your friends. And if you have not already, please subscribe to be kept up to date on all the latest episodes. And if you're so inclined, leave me a review on your favorite podcast platform. Thank you.